Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Elise. Today we will be talking with Missouri State Representative Judy Morgan about the bills that did and did not pass the 2019 legislative session. We will also be joined on the phone by Kansas State Representative J. Russell Jennings about the 2019 legislative session on the Kansas side. We will not be reading our calendar of events this week, but you will be able to find the calendar on the Jaws of Justice radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn.
This is Teresa Wilkie. Good Monday morning. I'm going to interview Representative J. Russell Jennings. He's on the phone with us from Great Bend, Kansas.
Good morning.
Well, good morning. We want to tell our listeners about the work of the Joint Committee on Corrections and Juvenile Justice this most recent legislative session. You all are finished now, correct?
That's right. We finished a week ago, sine die, so we're wrapped up for this year.
And thank you very much for being on with us. Russ, you're the chair of this Joint Committee, correct?
That is correct.
And how many years have you had the honor of doing this?
Well, I've served as chair of the committee for the past 3 years. I've been a member of the Kansas House for 7 years. I'm in my fourth term.
Well, I thank you. I thank you for your service. I think that's nothing short of terrific. So, lucky us that we get the chair. Can you talk to us about bills that were in front of the Joint Committee this past legislative session? And let's start with bills that you passed.
Sure. Well, I think probably the most significant piece of legislation that we passed this year was to create the Kansas Criminal Justice Reform Commission that will be studying our system of criminal justice in Kansas for the next 18 months. And we expect from them a comprehensive report on recommendations they might have to improve the efficacy of our system and to assure that we can provide for public safety, do so in an economical and an effective way to change behaviors of offenders. That commission will begin its work in August, and we'll have a final report in December of 2020.
And what part of the Kansas budget is currently for corrections? What do we spend? What percent?
That's a great question. Yeah. It's hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, we run a prison system with 10,000 inmates. We have certainly the community supervision component of that. And that doesn't take into account the real total cost when you take in the judicial branch and their activities, as well as all of the county's expenses with county jails and prosecutors. So it's hundreds of millions of dollars a year are expended on criminal justice in Kansas.
Right, and this bill is asking for reviews to see its efficiency. That's good. What else did you pass?
Well, we created greater opportunity for low-level drug offenders, both involved in cultivation and distribution of drugs, to participate in community-based residential and non-residential treatment programs as an alternative to prison. We recognize that substance abuse addiction is a driving force in criminal behavior, and feel strongly that reaching out and attempting to treat that addiction is a better course of action than simply incarcerating people. You know, we've had several bills involved with trafficking and domestic violence. I think the big domestic violence item would be a requirement that law enforcement officers at the time of interacting with victims of domestic violence assure that they are provided with critical information to help them provide for their own safety. In particular, notifying them of the availability of a victim notification system in Kansas that can let them know on a real-time basis when an offending individual is being released from county jail following a domestic violence arrest. We, as I'm sure many other states, have experienced some horrific instances of those offenders being released, victims not being aware that they've been released and having some pretty tragic consequences. So I think that was a pretty important bill that we passed.
I agree with you on that. And what else did you address?
We changed some of the sanctions that are available for those who violate the terms and conditions of probation. We had a system that allowed judges to place those violators in prison for either 120 or 180 days rather than imposing their original sentence. What we discovered through a study of the data was that, unfortunately, female offenders were suddenly being incarcerated in prison at a far higher rate than what they were prior to this change having taken effect several years ago. So we undid that. We removed that option from the court. We believe that it really cast a broader net and was bringing more people into prison for technical violations of probation than was prudent. And we've removed that ability of judges to use that as a tool in supervision of offenders. They can still revoke the probation and place them in prison. They're just not going to be able to drop them in for short periods of time. So they'll have to decide, has the offender's behavior warranted that kind of reaction, or should they look for other community-based alternatives to address offenders' technical violations of conditions?
Was there any part of that bill that addressed what could be done if people on probation were honoring their probation and needed to have the probation term shortened?
They have the opportunity to petition the court to go ahead with, if you will, good behavior on probation, to have that terminated. That's definitely going to be a subject for the Crime Commission to look at and really try to create an incentive program for compliance with terms to achieve early release from that supervision. You know, the bottom line is most offenders simply want off supervision. And I think if we give them some incentives around behavior and completing programs, that we can achieve better outcomes. And that's a good methodology, kind of a graduated sanction and incentive approach.
Now, then, your committee name is Corrections and Juvenile Justice Oversight. What in particular was passed to address juvenile justice?
Very interesting. Several years ago, we passed a bill, it's called Senate Bill 367, that was really a comprehensive change in the juvenile justice system. We had partnered with Pew Charitable Trusts. They helped us do a critical evaluation of the system. And so we made that change several years ago. And quite frankly, there were no bills introduced this year to do anything with the juvenile justice system. Kind of surprising, but I think probably the new changes from several years ago are just taking hold, and the jury may be out yet on how that's really working. But
well, what do you know about the Democrats?
Millions of dollars in costs, and have invested those savings into community-based alternatives for kids.
What do you know about the demographics? As a result of the work that you already did, has the number of juveniles in corrections reduced? Is there any
decline?
Absolutely.
Not so many years ago, we had four juvenile correctional facilities that had over 400 youth. Today, we have one facility, and it has around 155 youth in it. We have moved kids, really kept them at home, and moved services into their communities to provide them the necessary services locally. Only the most serious and chronic violent offenders end up in our juvenile correctional facilities, and that's as it should be.
Well, I commend you, Russ. I think you should be very proud of yourself, and I'm proud to be a Kansan. And I thank you very much for talking with us today. Now, we only have 2 minutes left, but tell me what you're most proud of or what you are most looking forward to.
Well, that crime commission that has been created, I think, presents some really wonderful opportunities to critically evaluate the criminal justice process. They'll be looking at diversion agreements, ways to avoid ongoing prosecution. They'll be reviewing the strength of community programs, all with an eye towards achieving the system outcome, which I think is changing the behavior of offenders in ways that they can become self-sufficient. And that's going to require some skill-building opportunities for offenders to be fully employed. And I think that's the greatest promise that that we've got out of this session is what the future might hold.
Well, I thank you for your service. I see your email, Russ, R-U-S-S dot Jennings, J-E-N-N-I-N-G-S, at house.ks.com. www.ncc.gov. So if you have, if our listeners are interested, they can contact your office and you can get them to information about this crime commission. And I really appreciate you stopping out in Great Bend, Kansas. So are you happy for all that rain out there, I bet?
Well, you know, western Kansas has not been inundated to the level that the central part of the, and eastern part of the state. So we've had good moisture that's beneficial. But as you drive across Kansas and you see the pools of water on fields, it's really quite devastating for the agricultural community in many parts of our state, as well as Missouri and others.
Yeah, you're a true representative to not just think of yourself, because it's good for you guys to finally get some rain, but to think about the impact on the whole state. So I thank you, Russ. It was a pleasure talking with you today.
Well, thank you very much. You have a great day.
You too.
This is Jeff Humfeld, and at the moment, we want to talk to our local state representative, Judy Morgan. Judy, welcome.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here, as always.
And we're going to kind of do the same thing that Terry did with Representative Jennings on the Kansas side. We're going to talk about some of the bills that passed and some that didn't. And I'm going to start out with the big one here, which is the abortion ban. And normally it wouldn't be something that you would think of when you talk about the criminal justice system, which is what we deal with. But the fact is that there are some criminal penalties attached to this bill. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what this bill is and what some of those penalties might be and the like. So,
you know, Missouri already has a very restrictive abortion bill, and this made it much worse. It actually bans abortions at 8 weeks. And again at 14 weeks, 18, and 20. And you may ask, why did they do so many different bans? And their thinking is if all the states that are doing this are really looking toward getting it to the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade. So Missouri decided to do it this way with these different ranges of bans, because if the Supreme Court outlaws the 8-week, it's going to be severed from the law, and then the 14-week can still stay in place. So that was the reason for that. In terms of the criminal charges, what you're talking about is if any doctor or anyone else performs or induces an abortion in violation of this particular law, they will be subject to a Class B felony, which means they could get 5 to 15 years in prison, and they would also be subject to losing their professional license. This bill has no exceptions for rape, incest, or fetal abnormalities whatsoever. And it also has what's called a trigger law as part of the legislation, which says if Roe v. Wade ever is overturned at the Supreme Court level, abortion will automatically become illegal completely in Missouri. So it's a very far-reaching bill. It will go into effect August 28th, with the exception there was one part that had an emergency clause on it, and that is that if a young woman under 18 seeks to terminate a pregnancy, right now she has to have the written informed consent of one parent. This also requires that the other custodial parent be notified, and that has already gone into effect because it had an emergency clause. The rest of the bill will be August 28th.
All right, and as far as those penalties, this is for someone that's performing an abortion, but also someone that induces an abortion.
Right.
So if a woman takes the morning after pill or whatever, they could be imprisoned from 5 to 15 years.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of somewhat up in the air right now. But you bring a good point. I mean, inducing could be a number of things. Some people, when abortions were illegal, induced abortions by very horrible methods, but that was inducing an abortion. So that's a good point. Now, some states actually clearly have made it illegal for a woman even to obtain an abortion from a physician.
I think I've even seen some things that some states will punish you if you go out of state to have an abortion. So let's go to the change in the mandatory minimum sentences.
Sure.
And this is something that's...
This is a good one.
Yeah, this is a good one. Mandatory minimum sentences are what's got our prisons busting at the seams, so to say. It doesn't take into account, you know, extenuating circumstances. So why don't you tell us a little bit about
You're exactly right. This is what's got us into a situation. My husband worked for the Department of Corrections in the early 70s. There were 3,000 people incarcerated. Now it's over 30,000. So that's from 3 to 30,000 in, like, you know, number of years, and it's primarily because of low-level, nonviolent offenders who have been given these mandatory minimum. So judges were given absolutely no discretion. If the sentence said 10 years, then they had to give that 10 years regardless of any other circumstances in that particular person's life. So what happened, and this is really interesting, this is actually very much bipartisan support. Republicans and Democrats support this. And so what it does is for nonviolent, low-level offenses, the judges will no longer have to adhere to the mandatory minimum sentences. They will have discretion. Now, for violent offenses, the mandatory minimum will stay in place. But for those low-level, and a lot of them are drug offenses. That's what's gotten a lot of people in prison, or low-level, nonviolent drug offenses. So now the judges will have some discretion. I think this is kind of an interesting little twist. When we were initially discussing this bill in the House, which pretty early in the session, we got an email from the executive director for Americans for Prosperity, which is kind of a conservative libertarian group, and they told us that they definitely supported the bill, and they would probably be recording our vote on it. So it was sort of interesting that a conservative group also was very much in favor of these of getting rid of the mandatory minimum for low violent offenses. So I was very pleased that that passed. That was a good thing the legislature did.
And you, of course, got a couple points with
that. Yeah, I kind of joked on the House floor when I got up to speak in favor of it with the sponsor. I said, you know, I usually kind of don't do so well with the Americans for Prosperity, but I may get a few points from them this time. I got a few chuckles from across the aisle.
I bet. Well, something that I think came out of all the things that happened down in St. Louis area behind Michael Brown and all this was the debtor's prison bill. And it's all about how these counties and cities and stuff have been using fines and stuff like that to as a tax, basically,
right,
on their citizens and going after people to pay extra. So what is the debtor prison bill?
Well, and actually it even goes beyond that. And I wasn't aware of this until we talked about this bill on the floor, but say like if you owed a fine, the judge could give you the option that you would go to jail, basically, to pay off your fine. So you would end up spending time in jail to pay that fine off. And then sometimes, in some jails, you would actually be charged a board fee, basically, for staying there. So the sponsor of the bill, who happened to be a Republican, gave the an example on the floor of a woman he knew, and he was from St. Louis County, from that area, and he said she had done maybe like a bad check charge or something like that, where she was being held responsible for that. But she ended up owing $10,000 in these debtors' fines for being in jail. So that's actually what brought him to the position where he wanted to take care of that, and he brought that bill forward. So no longer can people be put in jail for some kind of fine violation, and they're not going to be charged for being in jail. So actually the mandatory minimum and the debtors' prison both got folded into the same bill, which was House Bill 192.
You know, one of the things that you said that you were unaware of was these boarding fees. Something a lot of people don't realize is that a lot of people that come out of the penitentiary come out with thousands of dollars of debt to the state, mm-hmm, for very similar charges.
It's a little double whammy.
If you're in a class that is hard to employ in the first place, that's something that's just devastating. It can be used to violate you and take you back.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. I was very pleased to see both the mandatory minimum and the debtor's prison dealt with this session.
That House Bill 192, that kind of became a Christmas tree, so
right,
to say,
right,
of bills. Was there anything else there that passed?
Well, those were the two really main provisions, I think, that were substantive that passed in it. And unless I may be missing something, those are the two that kind of stood out to me.
And this is something that was controversial, I think, in some areas, was the domestic violence victims, allowing them to be released from the rental agreements. Why don't you explain what that is?
Yeah, that was another good one, and that's been in the works for 3 or 4 years. We've had some people working very hard on that. Basically, right now, if a person's a victim of domestic violence, sexual abuse, or stalking, any of those three crimes, they can actually be released from their lease without any penalties. That's what the statute does. I think the thinking is a lot of times the women who are victims of that kind of crime, the person who is the perpetrator sometimes lives pretty close to them. And so that's why they want to be able to get out of their lease without any penalties. They will have to sign a statement saying that they are a victim of such a crime. And then if the landlord asks for more information, they will have to provide either something from, like, say, a mental health counselor if they've been seeing somebody for the aftermath of dealing with it, or they could provide a police report or a court order saying they want the person to stay away from them. They'd have to provide some kind of documentation if the landlord asks. But if they do all of that, then they are to be released with no penalties from their lease. Kansas City actually adopted it. Councilwoman Jolie Justice sponsored the ordinance, and the city of Kansas City adopted something similar maybe last summer, I think. But this bill had actually been in the works. Senator Lauren Arthur carried it over on the Senate side, who was one of our House reps, who got elected in a special election last year to the Senate, and it ended up sponsoring under Representative Jim Neely, who happens to be a Republican. So this is another bill that actually had good bipartisan support.
The last one I have on my list of bills that passed I thought were important was the jury duty bill.
Yeah. Well, that was interesting. One of our local reps here, Representative Jerome Barnes, had the bill. It ended up passing under a Republican. As you well know, most of the bills, since the Democrats are the minority party, it's the Republican that gets passed. But Representative Barnes had the same bill. And it actually says if you're 75 years or older, you can be excused from jury duty. Now, it doesn't force you to be excused, but if you say, I would like to be excused, then you can be excused from jury duty if you're 75 years of age or older. And that did pass overwhelmingly.
I would say transportation could be a problem for a lot of people that are older like that.
Right, so, yeah.
Why don't we talk a little bit about some of the bills that didn't pass, and there's one here that I think you have a good story to tell about, dysfunction of the legislature, and that's the Guns Everywhere bill.
Oh, yeah.
Why don't you explain what that was and why it didn't go anywhere?
Well, the Guns Everywhere basically would allow guns in a lot of places that are not allowed now, like churches, bars, hospitals, amusement parks, you know, right now, election, you know, when you go to vote, your election precinct. Right now, guns are not allowed. Conceal and carry is not allowed in those places. This would open it up so that people could carry guns in all of those places. And then also college campuses. There was actually a separate bill on campus carry, and then I believe it was also part of the Guns Everywhere bill. It basically just kind of stalled. It did have a hearing, I believe, in the General Laws Committee, but it was never brought up for a vote. There were some other bills, similar kinds of bills. Not one gun bill passed this year, so that was a good thing. You know, Moms Demand Action was there in force in Jeff City. They were coming down pretty regularly. They all had their red shirts that said Moms Demand Action. They were very visible. They were trying to come from all over the state and talk to representatives everywhere, you know, because obviously those of us in the Kansas City area were on your side on this, but you're going to have to get support from other parts of the state too. So they really did a good job, I think, of doing that. So, yeah, that bill did not go anywhere.
The last one that I have on my list, and we'll talk some more about some other things, but is the Title 10 bill. And I'm going to ask you to explain this one because it's a little bit convoluted and there's a lot of things in this bill.
Yes, it's it is very convoluted. You're exactly right. It goes back to sexual assault on college campuses. And I'm not sure if it's Title 10 or Title 9.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that kind of threw me off a little. Is it Title 9, I think?
It is Title 9.
Yes, right. Okay, great.
I'm not Roman. What can I say?
No, that's okay. That's okay.
I sometimes get confused with my Roman numerals.
Right. During the Obama administration, he did what their department did, what's called a Dear Colleague letter, and they sent it out to all the college campuses saying that sexual assault is considered part of the Title IX protections, and they wanted colleges to deal with the sexual assault on campus. The numbers are very high. I think one in about four or five young women is actually sexually assaulted on campus. So we've heard, you know, probably everybody's heard Betsy DeVos when she came in with the Department of Education. She is going to very much weaken what President Obama's department put into effect. Those regulations have not come out yet. We expect them sometimes this summer. The Republicans in the Missouri House and Senate decided they would get a jump on it and do something even ahead of the regulations coming out. So it would actually weaken, you know, protections for the young women who come forward. It would allow cross-examination of them, even maybe bringing up their past sexual or drinking history. It would say that nobody could be forced to talk to an investigator as part of the proceedings. So there was a lot of conflict around it to begin with. And then the Kansas City Star actually published an article, which some of the listeners may have seen, where the lobbyist had been really working with the House and Senate in terms of trying to get this bill moving forward. And it so happened that the lobbyist's wife was on the administrative hearing board, that these issues could now go through if the young man thought that he does, you know, appeal, that he could appeal it to this administrative hearing board. And interestingly, there was a young man who had been through this on his own college campus and had been accused of sexual assault of a young woman, and his mother happened to be on the administrative hearing board, and his father was the lobbyist trying to push this bill forward. So when that article hit the Kansas City Star, it really put a stop to this bill. It slowed it down. It did not go any further. It was in committee at the time on both the House and Senate side, and I'm not sure what's going to happen next year, but I think that's what caused it to basically be derailed, is this article in the Star, because what a conflict that you are there actually protecting your own son who's been charged with sexual assault on a college campus. And I just want to add another thing that's kind of interesting to this. You know, Clean Missouri, which was passed by the voters overwhelmingly in November of 2018, had a provision that all of our emails as reps and senators would be sunshinable. So, you know, people can actually see our emails. Now, the Democratic caucus in the House, we had always contended that we thought our emails were open to the public. The Republicans said no, they did not think they were. Well, now they're open to the public. That Kansas City Star actually went through the Sunshine Law to get those emails, and that's how they found out what was going on. So that's just an interesting twist, that without Clean Missouri, they might not have been able to get those emails, whereas now they can.
The thing that bothers me about this particular bill is that, once again, it makes the victim right into the perpetrator. In other words, it's because of your bad behavior or whatever you caused this to happen to you. And once again, the young men that do this and have not been taught properly, they get away
right
with it. One of the other things that this bill would do was give them the right for civil action against the college,
yeah,
or whatever?
Yes, that's correct. I forgot about that. Thank you for reminding me. Yeah, if they figured they'd been mistreated, then they would actually have civil actions against the college to go after the college, too. So it was a pretty broad-reaching bill. The Senate version was probably a little bit worse than the House version. I think the House version did have some changes during the committee process, but neither one of them are good, and we'll have to see what comes out this summer. That's when we're expecting to get these new regulations, so we'll have to be on the lookout for those. And kind of a back to what you were saying about the males not being held responsible, I've had a number of people ask me in terms of that abortion bill, what's happening to the guys? Nobody's putting any responsibility on them in this, and they're exactly right. There's no mention of that whatsoever. Women can't do that by herself. So
there were certainly some bills that didn't get through that you expect to come back again next year? Maybe one or two
sure
good ones and one or two bad ones that you expect to come back?
Well, the Clean Missouri, I think, will come back in terms of the redistricting. You know, Clean Missouri had a number of different provisions, but one of them was that the redistricting, when we redraw those legislative boundary lines every 10 years, it's done in relation to the time when the census comes out. So all the legislative boundary lines are redrawn for the House and Senate seats, the Missouri House and Senate, and so Clean Missouri calls for a nonpartisan demographer to actually draw those lines. Right now, it's a pretty partisan commission that's appointed by Republicans and Democrats, but we found that both parties tend to want to protect their own boundary lines, and so it's not done in a nonpartisan way. So the redistricting made it all the way through the House, and it was over on the Senate side to actually take that constitutional amendment back to the people, because it is an amendment, so it has to be taken back to the people to basically put us back to the way we were, where it would be a partisan commission again with appointments by the governor and the state parties to actually draw the boundary lines, which those of us who've supported the nonpartisan demographer thinks that's going to take us right back to the gerrymandering and protecting incumbent seats and that kind of thing. So on the Senate side, it made it through committee, and it was in the fiscal oversight, which it has to go. There's a number of committees things have to go through to get to the floor for full debate. And interestingly, it went down on a 2-2 vote. There's actually 5 Republicans and 2 Democrats on that committee. 2 of the Republicans were not there. The third Republican decided to leave his vote, proxy vote, with the chair of the committee. And when it came time to vote, the 2 Democrats voted no. They wanted to keep what we've got now and not send it back to the voters. The 2 Republicans voted yes, and then the one Republican said, I've got the proxy vote. And Senator Jamila Nasheed, we owe her a great deal of thanks, because she raised her hand and said, you can't do proxy votes. That's illegal. And so it went down on a 2-2 vote. The 2 Democrats voted no. The 2 Republicans voted yes. You have to get a majority. So that will be back. I am quite sure that will be back again next year. We will be fighting Clean Missouri again next year.
One of the issues that I find very interesting, there were 2 or 3 bills to do away with the death penalty. They were all proposed by Republicans, weren't they?
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. There, you know, a lot of Democrats are against the death penalty, and we do have a handful of Republicans. I know T.J. Berry, who's been termed out. I'm not on any of the committees that would hear it. I'm not sure if it got a committee hearing, but that's one that's been around a long time. I generally sponsor the bill because I believe that we should get rid of the death penalty. So hopefully someday we'll be able to do it.
Well, Judy, we want to thank you very much.
You're welcome.
For coming
glad to be here.
Sitting here in my prime. What am I going to do now? Am I going to make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.